Thanks for tuning in today. Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And this week, as I am each and every month, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Craig Joseph. He's the Chief Medical Officer for Nordic Consulting. Craig, as usual, thanks for joining me today.
As usual, it is a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I try each and every month to not talk about the pandemic and variants, but unfortunately we have to once again. We seem to be knee-deep in these continued challenges. The Delta variant continues to expand its reach. HIMSS taking place. We're doing this at HIMSS. What's been your experience so far?
It's, I wouldn't say surreal, but maybe a notch below surreal. It's everyone is wearing masks everywhere you go in Las Vegas. And, you know, I had to go through, as did all of us, go through a pretty rigorous check to make sure that we were completely and fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Obviously, the numbers here are down. I don't know if HIMSS is or going to release their attendance numbers, but just looking at it, it's clear that the number of exhibitors and the number of attendees is significantly down than in previous years.
And I think we saw a decrease even in the near term of numbers of people coming based on the incredible increase, and we've seen a number of states that are just in disaster zones when it comes to this new variant. Well, it's not a new variant at this point. It is the major variant that we're struggling with, the Delta variant, that continues to expand. I think the two states that are competing for top position, Florida and Texas at this point.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't even think we should talk about the Delta variant anymore, because now it's just the SARS-CoV-2 virus that is omnipresent in the United States. It's almost all Delta. So it's the speed with which this variant has kind of taken over and is now responsible for virtually all disease from SARS-CoV-2 from COVID-19 is amazing. In a bad way. And so Florida, Texas, there are a lot of states that are much worse now. Here we are in August, I think it's August, and they were, you know, much worse than they've ever been from the entire pandemic. And we have a vaccine that protects against hospitalization and death very, very well. And so clearly this is related to people not getting vaccinated.
Yeah, so that's the number one strategy is get vaccinated, but unfortunately we don't have everybody taking that on board. News out recently, we've seen that Pfizer announced the results for their vaccination for 5 and up, and the results are great, good news. I think we'll see, I'm hoping, a rapid move towards approval for 5 and up. We've also seen something on pregnant, some approvals around pregnant women. I've heard of a number of cases, in fact, of people that could not or were not able to get the vaccine because they were pregnant, because we didn't see an authorization for it, but now we're seeing that. Any thoughts around that?
Yeah, well, I think for pregnant women, it was basically, what does your obstetrician say? So it was available, but a lot of people were naturally hesitant. CDC, I believe today, came out and said that they officially recommended it. So it was available, but a lot of people were reasonably concerned and wanted to talk with their physicians. So hopefully this will make pregnant patients much more willing now that we have more science and more data to support the fact that it's safer and just as effective.
And I'm going to say the 5 and up is good news, because that's a whole block of the population.
I wouldn't even say good news. It's just incredibly great news. And once we get an official emergency use authorization for kids 5 and up, it will put so many parents' minds at ease. I completely understand that. And really, it's, you know, you think, well, this is only affecting kids 12 and under, and that's a small percentage of our population. But there are so many parents that are afraid to kind of get back into society, even though they're fully vaccinated, right, because they know that there's a chance, even being fully vaccinated, that they might get infected. Their risk of serious disease or death is very, very low, but there is a risk of them communicating, even asymptomatically, to their to a child. And so there are a lot of parents who are reasonably saying, I'm fully vaccinated, yet I'm still not going to go back into society, and it's a shame. And if we can do any, you know, if this will actually help kind of us move back to what we used to think was normal, that would be great. So, yeah, I think it's fantastic news. And once it's actually, approved, it will be fabulous. You know, another thing that's happened is that Pfizer is seemingly getting closer to full authorization, not the emergency use, right, use authorization. And there are folks who, to me, it's you know, six of one, half a dozen of another. At this point, we're so close, and we understand so much about how the vaccines work. But there are people who are like, I won't do it until the FDA gives it a regular license. And so if we can get that for even one of the three vaccines in the U.S., I think that will push some people over.
And I think the full use authorization has been a sticking point for some of the mandates that we've seen. In fact, there's a large number of places that are now coming out in healthcare facilities that are saying, you know, if you work here, we're requiring it. In some school settings, we've seen it with some colleges, not with other colleges. There's a big spectrum. You know, perhaps that's the trigger, because mandating vaccines, as my daughter pointed out to me, is not unusual. She had to have vaccinations to attend her college, and she did for school as well. So this is not anything that's really new at this point.
That's true, although many people forget that. Certainly to get into kindergarten, you have to have a whole series of vaccines in every state. And there are various states have different rules about how that works and how you can get an exemption. And so this is nothing new, but to your point, none of those are EUA. Those are all fully approved by the FDA. And so as sooner we get to that with the data to support it, the better, no question about it.
And I think it's going to happen soon. The general consensus that I hear is, you know, we're talking in the next month or so, which is, again, very quick for the FDA actions, but, you know, appropriately cautious. They're trying to do the right thing, review all of the data. Obviously, at one end of the spectrum, it's, you know, what's taking you so long? And at the other end of the spectrum is, oh, my God, this is going too fast.
Yeah, I think that those are both true. And the FDA has been saying from the beginning that they will not rush any process. They're going as fast as they can. And once they have a sufficient number of data points and convincing information, then they will change the authorization status. And so I'm with you. I want it to go faster, and I'm also with you in that I want them to take their time.
Mm.
So it's hard to be them.
Yeah, no, I don't envy that position. They're obviously navigating a tough line. And, you know, part of the discussion that's been trending is around these booster shots. I know you talked about illegal boosters, right?
Well, I that's not the best adjective, but it is the adjective that I used. You know, there are folks that think that they need a booster, that a booster is a good idea. They may not be wrong. But today you can't just walk into a CVS or to your doctor's office and ask for a booster, at least in the United States. And so I've read about certain folks going to different states or doing other things to ensure that they can get a third dose or if they got the J&J to get a second dose of a different vaccine.
So we don't cross state lines for accessing alcohol or tobacco or whatever the other things that people used to do. I don't think that happens anymore, but now it's going across state lines for booster doses of vaccines.
And so in certain countries, they're already giving boosters and for certain patient populations. So certainly for immunocompromised, for elderly, you know, over age 65 or 70. There are people that are countries where they've decided that they do want to start boosters. So I suspect we are not far away. that's just, you know, based on what others are doing. And I also, you know, I, if you want to place a very low weight, we are in Las Vegas. If you want to place a very low wager, I would bet that all of us will be getting a booster at some point. Not in the far future, some point later this year.
Yeah, so in fact, the data is now out. They've published the data. And in the case of Pfizer, I haven't seen it for any of the other vaccines at this point. The results are astounding. We already saw astounding results for the effectiveness of vaccines from these two messenger RNA at levels that, you know, we haven't really seen in typically in these kind of vaccines before. But you put in a third booster and it's like it's Superman's involved in terms of protection.
Yeah, I will, as soon as the CDC says that we think this is a good idea for most people, I will be at the head of the line to get my booster, for
you,
sure.
You and me both, as I've said frequently, I'm always at the front of the line. I'm everything's a competition for me, so I'm right there with you.
Fair enough.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. As I am each and every month, I'm joined by Dr. Craig Joseph, the Chief Medical Officer for Nordic Consulting. We're talking and doing our show from HIMSS, where we've had our sort of lighter experience than before. There's pros and cons. And I have to tell you a little story. I took my hit for mental health a couple of days ago as part of my regular exercise routine. I was out and I go up. I don't know whether it's north, south, east, or west, but I go along one of the tracks in the Las Vegas road system for my exercise, and I find all sorts of mental health, or brain health as I prefer to call it, people who are lacking any lucidity. It is very clear that there is something going on in their world that doesn't connect them with the same reality that I'm in. I see them, I avoid them, you know, I look at them and I'm troubled by the whole experience. I've had a number of images that have really sort of troubled me, but in my early morning walk a couple of days ago, I was attacked.
Oh my.
And somebody came at me. Normally this happens and they sort of veer off, or I dodge them and, you know, we keep walking and nothing ever happens. But this guy actually, not sure where he was going, what was going on in his brain, but clearly I was something in his world. He struck me a few times, pinned me against the Jersey barrier. You know, the positive of this was there was a number of people that actually came. There was roadworks going on, and probably four or five folks came running up to sort of, you know, help me out. I didn't feel terribly threatened. I'm more sore than I thought I would be from that experience. But I was most troubled by what this message was and the experience of this and what we are doing in society and the juxtaposition of this city and the challenge of all of these people that you see everywhere, or you don't see, as you'll see in my post talking about this. They are almost invisible to us. We have tossed them out into the community, and all of the folks that were being nice supporting me, this guy disappeared off into the distance. They wanted to call the police, and I'm thinking that is about the last thing in the world that this guy needed. He did not need a police interaction, and yet we don't have another solution. How can we fix this problem?
Well, I, first of all, I'm glad to hear that you're okay. Secondly, I'm a little upset that you're giving me this problem to fix. And expecting a solution. Can I get 10 or 15 seconds to get my thoughts together and give you the answer? No. Clearly, it's a rhetorical question that you're asking, and there's no one solution. I think there are cities and cities here in the U.S. where they're looking at not sending the police, right? So when you when you call 911, they would be sending a team of you know, social workers, paramedics, others who have extra special training in dealing with folks who are in a different reality than you and me. To your point, because often the police know how to do one thing. They are very good at that. They are not excellent and never claim to be excellent at, you know, dealing with brain health problems, as I like. I think I'll adopt that. And so I think there are groups in cities and states where they are trying. It's a problem. Well, obviously, it's a problem. When I was a medical student, I rotated doing my psychiatry a rotation in a hospital that's all they dealt with. And those are generally state facilities because there's not a ton of money to be made in dealing with those kinds of folks in the U.S. system. And many of those institutions are no longer open. They don't exist.
Right.
They don't exist. And to your point, so where do these folks go who need that kind of help? And they might need it extensively and for a prolonged period of time. And the programs just aren't there that were even there 20 or 30 years ago because for a number of reasons. Money is one of them. Also, you know, some of those institutions were not great. And so you can imagine folks saying, well, we don't want those around, and they've proven that they can't really do a great job. But we don't have a replacement, right? The replacement is, let's pretend it's not a problem anymore.
All you remind me of is my experience in medical school. You had large hospital designed for psychiatric patients, 1,300 beds.
Wow.
Huge place. And they closed it.
Huh?
And I got a lot of questions from friends, you know, where are all those patients going? And I said, look around you, they're on the streets. I mean, if I was to pick the small incremental step, it's addressing that issue and saying, that's not the answer. You can't tip people up. So who is doing this? If you're familiar with experiences in cities, even in a small town, is there somewhere that is allowing for these folks to rehabilitate in a safe environment? I think part of the problem is I remember my psychiatric rotation very well. I had some, you know, pretty interesting experiences. And the problem was, we just didn't know. We don't understand. It's no different to replacing a hip in the, you know, the hip's broken or the brain's broken in some way, but we don't understand it in the same way that we understand the mechanics of a hip. And I think we struggle with treatments in this. So, you know, in the case of that individual, I knew he didn't need the police, but I also knew as a physician, I had no idea what I could offer him as a solution. Where do we start? Do we start by focusing on the money? You talked about that a fair amount.
Well, as you know, I'm fairly cynical, and I think the money...
Not at all. Not a cynical guy. I don't believe this.
A little bit. You know, I think step one, which again, some folks have already started doing, is involving the right people, right? So to de-escalate, at least from that, and what happens often when folks with guns come is it gets escalated.
Right.
Not pointing fingers or saying it's anyone's fault, but that's just what happens.
Yep.
They have tools that they can use, and that's what they do. So it's great that there are teams of folks, social workers, paramedics, others that can try and de-escalate and offer assistance. But to your point, what happens after that? Great, you've de-escalated this situation. Now, what's going to happen tomorrow? And so I think we're just going to have to be more innovative. There are other countries that deal with this in a different way. It's similar to me to the problems with homelessness. Now, a lot of that overlaps, but you know, giving folks places to live is much cheaper on average than treating them or doing these kind of Band-Aid. I guess what I'm trying to say is that the Band-Aid approach seems great in the short run, but is actually much more expensive than solving the problem, right? So again, I'm not equating homelessness with a psychiatric problem, but again, there's a lot of overlap and looking at different ways of figuring out how you correct homelessness, much in the same way we should be working and figuring out how do we get to these folks? Are there, where is the money? How can we continue to show that it's cheaper long-term, assuming it is?
I think it is. So, it's interesting you bring that up about the homelessness and, you know, having a place. And one of the challenges with the way that we approach homelessness is you've got to have a job, you've got to do all of these things that are very difficult for people in that circumstance. And I want to say it's a mayor or somebody, a leader in the community that is north of San Francisco on the other side of the bridge.
Oakland?
Yes, in Oakland. And he has created a program. He struggled. It was a big push for him to essentially give. There was no rent. There was no, we are going to put people into accommodation. We were going to provide accommodation. And he has shown absolutely, hands down, easy return on investment, the savings in terms of what that, you know, what they don't require, and the positive impact to the community that they were able to generate for these individuals by just giving them a home. And I know that sounds, gosh, you know, it's so socialist and whatever, but that's about humanity. I mean, all I could think of with this guy was he was somebody's son. That is, it's the humanity of this really bothered me tremendously. And if we don't approach it on that individual level, we're failing, but it's been shown. So why can't we do that elsewhere? How do we roll that out in other places?
Well, someone starts it, and then someone appeals to, it's one thing to appeal to humanity, it's another thing to appeal to the bottom line. And showing that it can be done safely and effectively. And so often you find folks who, you know, chronically can't hold a job.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking, I think it's reasonable to think, oh, well, you know, that's why they're homeless, because they can't hold a job. Often it's the other way around, right? Once you give them a home base, then they're able to, you know, get up at the same time and to be more consistent. And then it's a cycle that then just repeats positively instead of negatively. And so same thing with patients with behavioral psychiatric problems. How can we convince people that it's safe for the patient, it's safe for the community around where that institution is, and show, hey, long term, this is much better for society. And for those of you with minimal humanistic feelings, hey, this is long term going to save you money. We don't need to be taking your tax money to fix a problem that doesn't exist, because we prevented it in the first place.
Yeah, and I hate to be the rubber band that I keep snapping on my wrist and go back to COVID, but if we thought that the issues of psychiatric problems, loneliness, depression were bad before, I don't think there's a single statistic or data point that I've seen that suggests that COVID made all that better and, you know, things are going to improve. It's made things significantly worse, so we have a bigger problem to deal with. People that are in isolation. Are there any components, you think, to technology that might be able to help that? Do you think there's a technology part of the fix?
Well, technology usually plays a role, but I would say it's probably a minor role, right? We've certainly leveraged the technology as much as we can to when we're on lockdown, to have, you know, video visits both with our physicians and with one another. And so, you know, from that standpoint, think about before we had, you know, if this were to happen in the 70s or the 80s before we really had internet, the only way, if we're on lockdown for months, to see friends and relatives, right, would be not, there'd be no way. It would simply be having a telephone call. And so we had the video ability, and we had, social networks and other things to help us. Yet despite that, and that's the little things that technology can bring us, as you say, everything's gotten worse because of COVID. And it's not, of course, COVID itself. It's not it's what it's brought along with it. So I don't suspect that there's much technology more than what we've already leveraged, and I'm sure it's made a big difference, but the gulf is so wide that you're never going to solve that with a technological solution.
Right. And the inequity that typically exists is even more prevalent in that particular population, their ability to access. So this is really boots on the ground kind of approach. I think one of the most positive things, it was something that I wish I'd certainly thought of and wanted to do myself. If I was going to be remembered for something, this would have been it. And I was in a city, and it was essentially a not a camper van, but those big RVs, those are the words. And they had set this up as a shower system for the homeless. And they drove around and provided shower, clean clothes for the community. They would come in, they'd plumb in, hot water, allow them. And, you know, I don't think there's a time I don't get into a shower and go, I'm eternally grateful that I have access to this. It's simple things. I mean, I feel like these small steps could make a big difference. Accommodation would be a big one, although that maybe isn't an incremental step, but it could be. I mean, just imagine giving somebody somewhere to live that they know is theirs, giving them enough support infrastructure. So, troubling issue, but, you know, it's not going to go away.
Hey, an incremental step is thinking of these folks, the person that essentially attacked you, as someone's son or brother.
Right.
That's an incremental step, I think.
I like that. Direction. I think that's, you know, if I was going to leave people with something, it's exactly that. I you know, they did. The folks said, "Do you want to call the police?" I said, "No." I did warn everybody that I was walking back on the way, just to say, "Look, keep an eye out." But I'm sure he disappeared into the shadows somewhere. I wanted to help. I just didn't know how to. I think that's the other thing, is the frustration with it. So anyway, as usual, we've run out of time. Interesting to be here at HIMSS. I think certainly a different experience. I've seen some positives. I would say that my capacity to recognize people at a distance with just their eyes is zero. I'm hopeless at it. So if I walk past you and ignored you, that's why. Some people do spot me because I look like Gordon Ramsay, apparently, and they spot the hair. How about you? Have you had any good experiences?
No. Most people are better at recognizing me than I am of them, yeah, as you said. And I thought you were Gordon Ramsay. That's why I agreed to do this talk. So,
well, unfortunately, I'm not.
I'm embarrassed.
Craig, as usual, thanks very much for joining me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com, and tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.